It's the Burt Cohen Show. Guns. American history is full of guns. But we don't always want guns to be going off and destroying our domestic tranquility. That's there in the Constitution as well, not just the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is there. But what is the Second Amendment? What's it all about? Is it clear? Is it direct that it just unquestionably grants the rights of every individual to carry any and every type of gun anywhere he or she wants to do, no matter their mental state? Is that what the Second Amendment was meant to be? Well, I'm very, very pleased today to have as our guest Stephen Rosenfeld. We're going to talk about the history of the NRA, some legal history of the Second Amendment. Thanks very much for being with us. Stephen, are you there?
Oh, great. Hey, glad to be here. Fantastic.
Oh, good, good, good. Well, Stephen Rosenfeld is a senior fellow covering democracy issues for Alternet. He's a longtime print and broadcast journalist and has reported for National Public Radio, Monitor Radio, Marketplace, Alternet, Tom Paine, Salon, and many newspapers. He's written and co-authored three books on voting rights since 2004, including Count My Vote. Well, again, Stephen, thanks for being with us. Today's NRA, the National Rifle Association, is a bizarre twist, far afield from the traditional NRA. And it appears to me that these are radicals masquerading as conservatives, like Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and the 21st century NRA. It seems to me, again, are deliberately avoiding the true history of gun rights and gun control laws in America. In fact, as Stephen's going to tell us, America has always had extensive gun controls as the norm. What's abnormal is the recent libertarian-dominated deregulation of guns at the expense of genuine public safety. Well, again, Stephen, thanks for being with us. And you have a series of articles that are in process of coming out in Alternet and on Salon. In the most recent article, you say that the Second Amendment was hijacked by Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And you point out that in 1997, the Supreme Court Justice said he was an originalist who opposed interpretation of the Constitution to fit modern times. If he's an originalist and opposed to interpreting the Constitution to fit modern times, how the heck did he come to his current position on the Second Amendment, which was demonstrably at odds with two centuries of constitutional law?
Well, there are short answers and there are long answers. You know, the short answer with Scalia is he's always been a radical, and he was a radical college professor. He founded the Federalist Society. He was one of the co-founders with his students. And the whole idea emerged as part of a pushback against what he saw was liberal-dominated political movements and rhetoric and ideas. And what I mean by that is, he thought that there were too many, excessive interpretations for things he didn't really like, whether it was in the civil rights movement or, all this other stuff. It all came out of the 60s and early 70s. So, he and others sort of looked back with rose-colored glasses very selectively at what they thought was the early constitutional history of, of the American Revolution and the constitutional debates. And what he said was, he claims to be an originalist. But, you know, in that same, so, and then he gave all these speeches, and he was, you know, he's a very pugnacious New Yorker. He believes in sort of like giving and taking over the course of an argument. He kind of tests your mettle that way. And what he started doing was he started giving all these speeches once he got on the Supreme Court, and he went. You know, Reagan appointed him to the federal courts in Washington and then the Supreme Court all over 4 years. He was a professor. He was an intellectual, public, you know, public intellectual before that. And when he got there, you know, he started pushing for all kinds of versions of states' rights against federal authority. And one of those, in 1997, he gave this speech that you cited, claiming to be, you know, this vaunted originalist. But that same year, he authored a decision that basically stopped the Brady Bill from doing background checks. He said states don't have to comply. This is exactly what more or less John Roberts said in the healthcare debate. States don't have to follow, you know, the Medicaid, you know, the public sector expansion. They can do whatever they want. And all of this comes from this, you know, grandiose notion that, you know, individuals are, can only be entrusted to, you know, withholding, like, you know, the, you know, democratic values in their own hands. And when it comes to, you know, the NRA, they believe the only way you can express this epitome of American freedom is through owning a gun. It has nothing to do with, you know, like in a secular society with how you might, you know, achieve something through education, through jobs. You know, it's all expressed through having a gun. And so basically, you know, what happened with Scalia is over the years, you know, he's been very sympathetic to this notion that the Second Amendment includes, and we could get into this, you know, this, you know, an individual right to have guns. Now, historically, that's not what the Second Amendment was written for. And it's important to note that state constitutions have written about individual rights to have guns. But at the federal level, and guns for outside of this notion of a state militia, which is what the Second Amendment was about.
You bet.
And we can talk about what that really is and what the history is. And we can talk about why it didn't work. Because, for example, in the War of 1812, the British burned Washington because the state militias couldn't do a good job defending against the professional army. But what ends up happening is, you know, there's this selective editing of this ambiguously worded amendment that was poorly written to talk about, to sort of elevate this notion that, you know, only people who own guns can be the defenders against tyrannical government and liberty and all the stuff we hear today. And it's just like a giant myth, because the truth is, and this is what, you know, I've really come to, you know, I've researched, and this is through all kinds of academic papers, and all this research is it can be duplicated, is that the United States has always had a history of gun ownership rights and gun controls. I mean, you'd be amazed, in the early 19th century, all these southern states passed laws and banning the possession of concealed weapons and possessing guns in public and carrying them. And it wasn't because they were just afraid of slave rebellions. They were afraid of duels and domestic violence and other dumb stuff.
Interesting.
And out west,
right?
You know, the famous shootout at the OK Corral was about these guys who came into town who wouldn't turn over their guns to the sheriff's office. There were gun controls in these western towns because they wanted economic development. They didn't want to have people scare people away who had the money. So all of this is very handily forgotten,
right,
as we, you know, have like the modern NRA and the way they kind of consider like this sort of like the only true patriot is a citizen soldier, and there's no higher form of, you know, of duty as an American than owning a gun. I mean, it's just nuts. And it's not accurate.
You provide a very interesting perspective, because it's been odd for a lot of us to see what it is about some of the NRA members. Certainly, I don't think it's the majority, but some of the NRA members, not just liking their guns, but kind of worshiping their guns, being obsessed with guns, loving their guns, and the perspective that you just provided, that they see themselves as the vanguard in protecting our freedoms, that provides an interesting perspective. It's not really based on reality or history. And one of the things I have learned from history is that people well, basically, we never learn from history. That's the one thing we learn. But there is myth. There is what we choose to believe. And that oftentimes takes has much more power than actual history. And that's what we're here doing with our guest today, Stephen Rosenfeld, talking about the real history of gun rights and gun control in America. Their two are not mutually exclusive. Well, maybe we should actually look at the wording of the Second Amendment. Today, the NRA quotes only a part of the Second Amendment, and that is the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Stephen, what do they leave out of the Second Amendment? It's very short. What do they leave out, and why do they leave that out?
Well, they leave out the opening clause. And scholars will argue about this, and, you know, people disagree, they will just agree or disagree. But, you know, the way these constitutional amendments tend to be written is they have an opening clause that then sort of, like, establishes the subject, followed by whatever, you know, then needs to be said about that subject. And the opening clause of the Second Amendment is about a well-regulated militia.
Right.
And we have to understand, what is, did they mean by a militia, you know, in the 1780s?
And
that is, you know, it's not the National Guard of today, although that sort of descends from it. What it was during, you know, at the time of the American Revolution and before that, the problem with most European nations, including Great Britain and the way they managed their colonies, was they had standing armies. And they used those armies to oppress. And so coming out of that, you know, the American Revolution was you know, the colonialists banded together under what, you know, before they were called states, they were, you know, the different territories had their, you know, citizen soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, after the Revolutionary War, before there were the Articles of Confederation, there was the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights came a dozen years later. There were a bunch of Revolutionary War veterans who were really kind of disgruntled. They felt like they didn't, you know, they were paying taxes again. And, you know, the people in Washington didn't really quite know, you know, who were trying to figure out how to, like, have a national government, what to do with them.
You bet.
So in a certain sense, you know, people say that the Second Amendment was kind of a throwaway to appease disgruntled vets at the time. And the only time, but there were real concerns about being able to have, because there weren't organized police forces, and there wasn't a national army. There were less than, I think Congress, the first Congress, said that you could only have, you know, less than 1,000 soldiers in all of the United States.
Yeah.
So you had this notion of, like, state militias that would be organized when necessary. And they had different purposes. I mean, Massachusetts, they put down, you know, this raid, right, what's called the Shays Rebellion, which was to raid an armory in Springfield, which is where all the guns were kept,
mm-hmm,
the entire colonies, that was the armory. And at the same time, you weren't even allowed to have a loaded gun in a house in Boston. There was no right to self-defense. In the American Revolution, guns were confiscated for use by the Revolutionary Army. You had to appear for annual registries in public where your guns would be inspected by state officials. And then you weren't allowed to have even a loaded gun in your house. It would be confiscated. This is Massachusetts, and then you also weren't allowed to store gunpowder except on the top floors because it could ignite and cause fires. So there were all these laws. And that was just Massachusetts. Other states had many parallel laws. But the point about this militia thing was that, you know, it was sort of, it was a reflection of the times. And as I said, when the British invaded in the War of 1812, which everybody completely forgets, you know, the states tried to call out these militias to defend, you know, Washington, D.C., and it completely flopped. Washington was burned to the ground. And then the progress of history moved on. And that amendment, and the other one that, you know, that's right after that, to not quarter soldiers, mm-hmm, in anyone's home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they mostly were seen as historical artifacts until they were resurrected you know, much, much later.
So was it the case that the Second Amendment was put in, at least in part, out of being afraid of things like the Shays Rebellion, where there were, as you say, disgruntled revolutionary soldiers who didn't like to be taxed so that they could pay back the creditors? So was this to enable a militia to put down this violent uprising? Was that part of it?
That was part of it. That, you know, that rebellion, if I'm, you know, I have my notes in front of me, but I have to dig it up exactly. If I'm not, if I, you know, I stand corrected. I think it was, you know, it was just, it was less than a year from the actual, you know, meeting of the Continental Congress.
Yeah, it was very, very short.
You know, so, you know, all of this stuff was in sort of like the current politics of that day. And what ended up happening as you move into the early 1800s is that a lot of states had different gun control laws because there weren't many, there weren't handguns then. There weren't automatic weapons then. There weren't machine guns then. There were muskets, single shot, And what ends up happening is that, different states start writing into their constitutions the rights, to have weapons or bear arms for self-defense. But it was sort of, it was seen as, it wasn't really seen as sort of like a big issue or a big deal or related to a fundamental defining of what it is to be an American and like the first freedom or, maybe even all that came way later. And what ended up happening is that, after the Civil War, you actually had a lot of gun control laws in the states. In the South, you had them. You had them. It wasn't just because of the slaves. You also had them out west. I mean, Hollywood created this entire myth that was completely exaggerated.
Yeah.
I mean, the most famous Western of all, arguably the shootout at the OK Corral, which, how many movies have been made of it? It was a gun control fight.
And that was in Texas, I believe?
That was in Tombstone, Arizona.
Tucson, okay.
But these, it's like if you think about it, it's like it's kind of funny. I mean, like the Chamber of Commerce today was not that different than the Chamber of Commerce of yesteryear. They didn't want gunfights on the streets or people walking around with guns. They wanted people to come in and invest money.
Of course. If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, we're talking to Stephen Rosenfeld, who is talking on his cell only because work is being done on his house and it would be impossible to hear. So we appreciate that. May not be the ideal audio quality, but it's better than having all those hammers going on in the background. We appreciate that. We're talking about the history of gun rights and gun controls, the actual history. Is there not evidence that at least some of the founders agreed that gun possession needed to be balanced with gun safety laws? What do you think? We can't know for sure, obviously. What do you think the founders, or at least many of them, because they disagreed amongst themselves, what do you think they would have said about today's gun shows? How would it fit with their intentions?
Well, I think we can know about this. There's an amazingly well-written and well-researched book by a UCLA law professor named Adam Winkler. It's called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And it's very even-handed. And what he points out as his central thesis is that there's always been a combination of gun controls and gun rights. And if anything, in the early days of the country, there were more gun controls than rights. And that's completely opposite of what the NRA would have you believe today.
Right.
Many states, especially southern states, in the early 1800s, they Louisiana, Alabama, today's red states, they banned, carrying concealed weapons. It wasn't just because they were afraid of slave rebellions, which, in Haiti, 1805 or thereabouts, there was, the slaves overthrew the French. There was some similar, rebellions in Louisiana. The United States passed a law banning slave importation. But at that point, they weren't afraid of slaves arming themselves and having uprisings. That came after the Civil War. when slaves were freed, and all the guns that were manufactured in the North and the South for that war all of a sudden were taken home.
Yeah.
That gave rise to things like the Ku Klux Klan and everything like that. But in the first, the early, half of the 19th century, many of these states, that we consider red states today, they had very strict gun control laws because they didn't want, they didn't want to have people stepping outside and, because their honor was insulted or their girlfriend was insulted or somebody said something that, or who knows what, and having these duels.
Well, I was going to ask, how common were these duels? How often, how common was it for quarrels to be settled with duels? And my sense is, my guess is that, imagine that, Hollywood exaggerated that. Was it really that common? But that was one reason, I'm guessing, why gun control laws sprang up, because they didn't want that kind of thing. The Wild West was probably not really that wild, I would think.
Well, no, we're talking about two separate things. The dueling stuff, this fellow, Anna Winkler, cites other gun historians who basically say, they make some really interesting points. They say that the gun laws in, the early 1800s were written in racially neutral language in the South, which is really revealing. Because he points out that there are many laws that were not written in racially neutral terms. And so it was enough of a problem that they were the legislators of those days did that. But then after the Civil War, it was a whole another thing because all the guns that were had been manufactured, the thousands and thousands and thousands,
right?
They were back in civilian hands, and it wasn't just in the South; it was also in the North.
Sure.
But in the South, the former Confederacy, they were afraid that blacks who had fought in the army would defend themselves. And that gave rise to groups, the best of whom are known is like the Ku Klux Klan. And these were, essentially disarmament, posses. And out west, there was a corollary but it was more like an economic development thing, Dodge
sure.
City. All these names in the Western movies,
mm-hmm.
Dodge City, Tombstone, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
You had to turn in your guns at the sheriff's office. And if you think about this, this is the stuff that the NRA says today would be like the sky is falling. Oh, my God, the government's going to come in to confiscate our guns. We're going to have to register our guns. We're going to have to tell, the authorities. This was standard operating procedure. This was standard operating procedure.
Right, and I read somewhere, I believe in your article, about all patriotic citizens being expected to register their guns. It was just something that people did. And that was that in Texas, or I'm not sure where that was?
Yeah, that was really, really interesting. That was a really fascinating quote that I dug up. And what that was I think it was James Stephen Hogg, H-O-G-G, who was the governor of Texas in the 1890s.
Right.
And let's see if I can find that quote. Now, this is what's so interesting. He says, quote, "The mission of the concealed deadly weapon is murder. To check it is the duty of every self-respecting, law-abiding man." That's really interesting and powerful language because, today, the NRA basically has this narrative, and it began in the 70s, that the only good people are the people who can be trusted are good people with guns, because
mm-hmm.
you can't trust the government to do to protect us all.
For sure.
The governor of Texas in the 1890s says the mission is of every self-conscious. The mission of the concealed deadly weapon is murder. To check it is the duty of every self-respecting, law-abiding man. Well, today, it's like, the NRA has this myth that, you have to take the law into your own hands, as exemplified by having guns, because you can't trust the government or anybody else to do what it's there for.
Right, right. We have to take the law in our own hands. It's fascinating. It just turning actual history completely upside down and ignoring it and pretending it didn't exist. You mentioned the Ku Klux Klan and that book by Adam Winkler, who says, and this I found fascinating, the Ku Klux Klan originated as a gun control organization.
Exactly right. Well, the Ku Klux Klan, it was a name that, as Winkler points out, that was, it was created by, it was actually the name of a fraternity that was in one of the southern states, in the early 1800s, that was quickly adopted. And, like, Kluklos is Greek for, brothers, Kluz of, and it was an alliteration that became popular, and it became a brand name on, like, soaps and all kinds of crazy stuff. But at the time, there was this widespread notion that the returning Confederate war veterans, especially the people who were white and had some positions of power in the, in the ruling class that was there, they had to disarm the blacks because they just felt that they felt like they just had to do it. They were, the times were so, the war might have been over, but the prejudices remained. And, you think of, the Supreme Court decision around that time, Separate but Equal, the Dred Scott, mm-hmm. is sort of like embodying all that really embedded race prejudice. And so that's what happened. And, that's how it began. And, they would go out. Then they as Winkler says, they begin to, by doing these pranks to try to scare, the former slaves, and then they got much more serious, with the lynchings and the terror, and but it was all fundamentally about disarmament.
And in the late 1960s, when the Black Panthers scared a lot of white America by arming themselves, I believe, I'm not sure on this, that the NRA was not in favor of their gun rights. It seems to be pretty opposite of what they're saying now. Maybe you can shed some light on that.
Well, it's an incredibly fascinating thing to read about. And if you're into history, all you can do is shake your head. Okay, so today we hear the NRA say, by any means necessary, right? As they defend their gun rights. Well, the person who was most famously associated with that, and who was the first person in the 60s who was best known for saying that the Second Amendment, conferred a right to, to bear, to have a gun, was Malcolm X.
Ah, interesting.
Okay,
And that wasn't popular with a lot of whites at the time, I'm sure.
That was not popular with a lot of white people. So then what happened was, I'm in San Francisco, so, what happened was, Huey Newton, one of the Black Panther leaders,
right,
went to San Francisco Law School, and he discovered that there was nothing in California law that prevented somebody from walking around with a loaded gun in public as long as it wasn't pointed at somebody. So he started, confronting the Oakland police. The Panthers started carrying guns in cars. They started doing one of the big themes of the 60s was that a lot of the racial violence was in part because the cops incited some of it because they it was a way of sort of enforcing social inequality.
Absolutely.
Today people say, it's guns aren't the problem, crime is the problem, criminals. Well, it was the same thing back then, except nobody really, until the late 60s and Lyndon Johnson and the Kerner Commission reports, people wouldn't say what the causes of crime might be, such as lack of jobs, lack of education, lack of housing. And so anyway, the Panthers would go around trying to take over the policing functions in Oakland, California. And there were some laws that were being considered in Sacramento, the state capital, about some kind of gun control thing. So they decided they would show up at the state capital, two dozen of them, with shotguns.
Right.
And you can just imagine this spectacle today. Can you imagine, two dozen, young, militants, African Americans walking into an all-white state capitol, holding shotguns, and the cops know very well they can't do a thing about it because they know that these guys know the law. Well, that happened in May 1967. And it prompted Ronald Reagan to say, you know, this is ridiculous. That's the governor. He said, there's no reason why people have to walk around with loaded guns.
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I can dig up the quote and read it to you if you want me to. But that's essentially what he said.
Yeah.
And basically, I'll try to see if I can find it while we're talking. And, you know, basically,
Well, we're talking, if you just tuned in, with Steve Rosenfeld, who writes for Alternet and many different sources. He's been on many different journals, Monitor Radio, Marketplace, and he's written a series about the real history of gun control and gun rights in these currently United States. And it's a fascinating history. It's not what the NRA wants us to believe. And at some point, we got to talk about what the heck happened with the NRA. But we need to look into the history at first. But go ahead. Did you find the quote from Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, we did. So what happened was, you know, the Black Panthers show up, and this goes right into what you want to talk about. You know, they show up in May 67, carrying, you know, loaded rifles into, but they're not pointing them at anybody. Mm-hmm. They're either pointing them up to the floor or to the ceiling, into the California State House, the Capitol building, and to protest gun control, you know, proposed gun control legislation. In fact, they didn't even know where to find the hearing room. They just were walking around. They had to be told where to go. And so Reagan says in a press conference immediately afterwards, quote, there's no reason why on the street today a citizen should be carrying loaded weapons, unquote. And then he said guns were, quote, a ridiculous way to solve problems that have to be solved among people of goodwill, unquote.
The right-wing hero, Ronald Reagan, who was really not right-wing at all, actually. He was a genuine conservative.
What ended up happening was the first federal gun controls were in the 30s in response to the gangster and mob violence using machine guns during the Prohibition era. And FDR, in his first year in office, was the victim of an assassination attempt that failed. He made gun controls part of the New Deal, you know, sort of a law and order, and the NRA supported it back then. And then fast forward to the 60s, you know, the gun that Lee Harvey Oswald used was bought from a classified ad in the NRA's magazine American Rifleman. It was an Italian military surplus rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And in hearings that followed, congressional hearings, you know, weeks after the assassination, the NRA's, you know, person, you know, vice president or person who testifies on the Hill, says that nobody can object to banning the kind of gun that was used to kill the president. You know, no sane, I think he uses the phrase, you know, sane, you know,
right.
American. And nothing happened with gun control laws until 68, after Kennedy,
right.
Robert Kennedy Jr. and Martin Luther King were assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government at the time, you know, Lyndon Johnson wanted a registry of all gun owners.
Hmm.
Not very different than the way that, you know, Massachusetts had one in the revolutionary times. It didn't happen, but what the law did was it began to establish like more procedures for registering sellers of guns and people who could be banned from owning guns. It expanded the categories from felons from the 30s to people who were drug addicts and mentally ill and stuff like that. And what happened was, as you go into the 70s, a lot of people in rural America, you know, gun owners and gun dealers, that they were being unfairly punished for the problems of the big cities. And within the NRA itself, there was a split between people who really wanted to see a much more expanded version of the Second Amendment, and where the federal government would sort of protect gun owners' rights, because what happened was, the white people of America were afraid of what was happening in the 60s.
Sure.
And they were afraid that their ability to take care and protect themselves was being compromised by big government, and where they saw all these expanded versions of other constitutional rights, like under the First Amendment for freedom of assembly and things like that for the civil rights groups. They wondered, why aren't we seeing the same thing with the Second Amendment and gun rights,
mm-hmm.
at least on the federal level?
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter what you have in a state constitution, the federal constitution is supreme.
Right.
So what ended up happening was there started being articles in the magazines, American Rifleman, and some other law journals that were saying it's time for the Supreme Court to, you know, expand the Second Amendment. And within the NRA itself, there were some hardliners, and who really felt that the organization should stop being such a sort of, you know, middle class and upper middle class hunting and, you know, sportsman type group, and should reach down and like sweep in like the Vietnam vets, a more blue collar base, and really just start making this notion that we are the true patriots. You know, we only Americans who have guns can really defend what is true in red, white, and blue. And there was a leadership coup in 1977, and the old NRA board was kicked out. The new one was put in. They changed the motto to what is now the right to bear arms.
Shall not be infringed. Right?
And then, and the guy who led it, by the way, was just like this fellow George Zimmerman, you know, who was accused in Florida of shooting Trayvon Martin when he was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
He went after some in Texas. He went after some Mexicans, young men who he thought might have stolen his family's car. He wanted to bring them back to his house. They said no. One pulled a knife. He shot him. He shot the guy with a shotgun. Killed us. Another teenager. You know, was led off in self defense. This was the guy who led the NRA's internal. His name was Harlan Carter. So then what happens is Reagan gets elected president, in part with the NRA being part of this coalition.
Yes.
And that's when things really started changing, because Reagan really adopted this libertarian cowboy language, and that's when Congress started deregulating laws. You know, that's when they created what's called the gun show loophole, and it just goes on and on from there.
Yeah.
You had these fights at the time. That's when the police and the mayors started becoming. They went from being the NRA's best friends to like the bitter enemies.
Yeah.
Because the cops wanted to outlaw certain kinds of bullets.
Mm-hmm.
The NRA said, no, you can't do anything. They had complete absolutist, stances. And things only got worse, not better, after that. Because after Reagan's assassination attempt, he, unlike FDR, he said, I'm not going to call for gun control. Although when he was out of office, he backed the so-called Brady Bill, for his press secretary who was shot and had brain damage.
Right.
And what ended up happening, is that when Clinton got into office and he passed the assault weapons ban and the Brady Bill,
right.
What quickly happened was it was used as a way in midterm elections, kind of like the Tea Party in 2010, to oust the Democratic Congress. And from that point, pretty much until today, Democrats have been really scared to do anything to stand up to the NRA, except for people who are, victims or firsthand witnesses to gun violence,
right.
Like Dianne Feinstein, who walked into the San Francisco City Hall after Harvey Milk, was shot by another supervisor and was holding the guy, bleeding to death, and
mm-hmm.
Gabrielle Giffords, and stuff like that. But and that's where we've been for the last 30 odd years. It's been an amazing political run. And
it's quite a turnaround from, you suggested when the NRA was founded back in 1871, it actually was a gun control organization. Is that right?
Yes, it was a training. Yes, it was founded. Okay, this is such a rich topic. And, it was founded by an ex-New York Times reporter and somebody else from New York State who felt that the Northerners couldn't shoot well enough during the Civil War against their Southern, opponents, because they weren't trained, they weren't trained to use guns.
Yeah.
So they created an organization for better marksmanship and training. And that's what it was for decades and decades.
But they also favored gun control in, not just shooting straight. I mean, that's one thing they're still in favor of very much.
They at that particular point, there was no federal activity really for gun controls. It was at the state level. And that's why you had, states like Florida, states like Texas, states like Louisiana, Alabama, today, what people consider, really red states. You know, passing laws like, you know, you couldn't carry a concealed handgun. You had to check your guns, you know, when you come into, like, you know, like within certain, like, city limits, you know, all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah.
And but that was at the state level.
Sure.
But at a certain point, because if you think about it, you know, it was states that and cities that organized police forces. And, you know, all of that was sort of a late 1800s, you know, phenomenon, you know, during, like, the great urbanization, you know, period of the country. And it was only after, it was in the 1930s. When the need for national responses were seen in the Depression, so a whole range of issues, at crime, cracking down on crime, you know, became, you know, the reason for the first federal gun control laws, which banned machine guns, essentially, by imposing taxes on it. And it's very, very interesting. The federal, you know, the federal judiciary and, you know, the FDR, they didn't want to really, they approached banning machine guns by imposing taxes
right.
on them. They didn't want to touch the Second Amendment because they wanted to make sure that the federal government and the Supreme Court went along with this, you know, had, you know, strong law and order powers, you know, in terms of fighting crime.
Well, and that's,
yeah.
I'm understanding a bit of, some of the more libertarian right-wing members of the NRA, certainly not all of them, but talking about now, you know, mistrusting federal authority, wanting to return power to the states, which is an interesting discussion. But it was also true, if I'm correct, that many of the states had rather strong gun control laws, more than the federal government. So
that's absolutely true. And the thing about it is it's just, what ends up happening, you know, in politics in America, you know, today, maybe with politics in America all the time, is that when things get emotional, you can't have, like, a rational discussion based on facts. You know, you descend into, these are my beliefs, how dare you tell me what not to believe.
Right.
You know, you can't tell me what to feel, you can't tell me what to believe. But really, until basically the 1980s, for the first 200 years, gun controls and gun rights were seen as being, you know, wedded at the hip. They were tied together.
Sure. Yeah.
And there were more gun controls than there were gun rights.
And there was no conflict of it. I found most fascinating this next quote that I got from your one of your articles from Carl T. Frederick, who was head of the NRA. This quote from 1938. This is a guy who was head of the NRA. Listen to this. Quote, "I do not believe in the general promiscuous toting of guns. I think it should be sharply restricted and only under licenses." This is the head of the NRA. This is their traditional position. I think a lot of people would be kind of surprised at that, that, you know, it's only after that coup that you cited in the late 1970s that the NRA changed. This is not American tradition. This is not adhering closely to the original intent of the Second Amendment. Again, I got to read this quote again. This is the head of the NRA in 1938. Quote, "I do not believe in the general promiscuous toting of guns. I think it should be sharply restricted and only under licenses." I think that's fascinating. Has the Supreme Court ever actually declared that the Second Amendment means an individual has a right to own a gun? Has it ever been made that clear?
Well, it was made that clear in 2008 in what's probably, you know, the biggest example of
judicial activism
by Judge Scalia, who claims to be the constitutional originalist. I mean, you know, I dare say he is the most incredible hypocrite as a public intellectual. Look, he's entitled to state his beliefs.
Of course.
And defend his beliefs. But don't mislabel your beliefs. You know, and it's a fraud. And it's absolutely amazing. You know, one detail I kind of dug up, which I just found to be just remarkable in terms of symbolism, is the day that Scalia joined the Supreme Court was the day that the Chief Justice who was appointed by Nixon,
Warren Burger.
Warren Burger. That was his last day. Now, Burger, after he left the court, he got really upset with this advocacy by the NRA that there was a constitutional right to, you know, to individual gun ownership. So he spoke out. He wrote this article in Parade magazine. Now, people will forget what that was. Maybe some will remember. But he used
Parade.
To be insert in every single Sunday paper in America.
Yeah, it was Parade.
For a time. And he said it was just a fraud. He said, you know, he just discussed it. And he said there's a scourge of handgun violence. And not only, he said, should there be gun control laws. He said when people sell guns, this is Nixon's, you know, Supreme Court, you know, Chief Justice, who was a hardcore law and order guy.
Absolutely.
He said when people sell guns, they should be like a title transfer, like when you sell a car or sell a house. That's what Burger said in Parade magazine. And then he went on public television, the news hour, a year later, I think it was 91, and called it one of the greatest constitutional frauds by a public interest, you know, advocacy organization ever,
yes.
You know, in his lifetime. But what happened was, there are people who are guilty of excessive behavior on the right and on the left.
Yes.
So let's talk about the left, you know, the gun control side. Because what happened was when people overreach, and this might be a cautionary tale for what just passed in New York State, by the way,
mm-hmm.
With their new gun control laws, there's always some kind of blowback.
Yes.
And so what happened was the city of Washington passed the world's, you know, the nation's toughest handgun ban. It was 1976. And crime went up in Washington. And because it's the District of Columbia, there's no state constitution or layer of government. Everything is like all federal. So that's why people file lawsuits in Washington, D.C., because they think it's the quickest way to, you know, to change or get a ruling from the Supreme Court on constitutional issues. So what happened was a bunch of libertarian lawyers decided to go after Washington, D.C.'s handgun law. And this was 2002. The NRA didn't want them to do it, actually. They tried to discourage them from doing it because they didn't want a Supreme Court ruling in the tradition of Warren Burger, saying, you know, this, you know, gun rights are, you know, there are no individual gun rights
right.
in the Second Amendment.
Right.
But it turns out that, you know, Scalia then was on the court, and he answered the questions put by other justices to these lawyers when it got to the Supreme Court for these libertarian lawyers. All they did was stand in front of the bench and say, yes, Justice Scalia, as you say. And then he wrote the opinion. And what he did was he said that there is an individual right in the Second Amendment to have a handgun at home for self-defense. And he said there can be other gun controls, you know, beyond that. Which is today people say grants, you know, Obama and the governors in New York and other states, you know, tremendous power to regulate guns. But he created, you know, for the first time, you know, in, you know, Supreme Court doctrine,
right.
You know, an explicit holding that the Second Amendment contains a right to a gun for individuals, an individual right within the home for self-defense. And it's only handguns, and there's a lot you can talk about to criticize that. You can say, well, handguns are the ones that are most commonly used in most of the domestic violence and most of the homicides. It's not the assault. The focus on assault weapons is, you know, it's the exception. It's not the rule, and all that sort of stuff. But nonetheless, you know, that's the legal landscape now, and it was.
Well, I thought it was interesting.
Some people talk about a living constitution, an evolving constitution, where you have to update the laws to reflect the times. Well, you can believe that or not believe that. Personally, I think that's pretty realistic. But I don't pretend to call myself an originalist
right.
who says that, you know, nothing must change from this, you know, sacred document that was, you know, you know, as it was written, you know, in 1870, you know, in 1880, whatever. But Scalia did. And then he came and wrote the decision that basically was like the most blatant example of judicial activism or reinterpretation of a, you know, a constitutional right, you know, in many, many years.
And who were, so it was a 5-4 decision. And I wonder who the four were, or more important, what their arguments were when it came to District of Columbia versus Heller in 2008 and the Second Amendment. What was the argument of the four?
Well, it's the same four who you would expect. It was Alito, it was Clarence Thomas, it was Kennedy, and I'm forgetting,
I can't think of it either. But that was the five in that. But on the other side, we don't need to necessarily know who it was who voted, you know, in the 5-4 in the minority. But I wonder what their take on the
Well, their take, it's very interesting what their take was. You know, Justice Breyer wrote a defense that law professors tell you was way smarter and, you know, more accurate and more subtle than Scalia. And as recently as last October, Stevens, he was giving a speech basically talking about this, and he just said that, you know, he just said it's flat out wrong. It's just, you know, what happens is what judges can do, and bad judges do this all the time. It's not very different than, you know, a preacher who will just, you know, pluck a phrase from, like, you know, a chapter and a verse and reach a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, right.
You know, honestly, this is why who is on that court is so, so important.
Yeah, absolutely.
And basically, you know, it's like, you know, people, when they, like, heard about the healthcare decision, they just sort of shook their heads, and they said, what is this tax issue? What is this notion that, you know, states don't have to follow the federal government when it comes to, you know, providing public health care programs for the poor or the elderly? It's the same kind of fabricated federalist fantasy that, you know, states have certain rights except when they don't have the rights, because I don't want them to have the rights. I'm trying not to be too breezy, but it really kind of comes down to that kind of reasoning at its base. I mean, today, for example, we are talking about, you know, Obama's talking about, you know, better background checks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Scalia wrote the opinion in 2007 saying that states don't have to submit information to the FBI's background check system. They can if they want to, or they don't if they don't want to. Well, there's different kinds of information that the states will submit. There's stuff that comes from the courts, judicial records, and then there's other kinds of records that might involve, you know, mental health procedures. Well, 17 states, Obama said, presented less than 10 records to the FBI last year. I mean, you know, and this comes from a decision that Scalia wrote in 2007 saying they don't have to do this. And it's based on this belief that big government is too big,
right,
you know, and states should go their own way. And, you know, it's a whole old fight, you know, over states' rights versus, you know, federal government, national government. And
it seems like that's, you know, kind of a new line of the old culture war that, you know, the old South, quite frankly, is probably for this brand new interpretation that, you know, individuals have an unrestricted right to carry any kind of gun anywhere. But in, you know, on the blue states, we tend to feel differently. Is it fair to say, Stephen Roosevelt, is it fair to say that gun laws across the United States used to be tighter and have only been loosened up in recent decades, and that totally consistent with the Second Amendment, their, you know, tradition has been for gun control? Is that an accurate statement?
It really is an accurate statement, and I'll tell you, it's so interesting, because if you take a look at the executive orders that Obama signed, forget what Congress is going to do. The executive orders that he signed were designed to undo specific acts of past Congresses to either deregulate gun controls or to basically prevent federal agencies from doing research into gun violence. Now, this is a really big part of this. What happens is, in politics, the ideas come first, and then the organizing comes, and then the politicians react and everything like that. Well, for years, at the same time that the the NRA has been pushing this notion that the only true patriot way to express patriotism and freedom in America is to own a gun,
mm-hmm.
but there's no other way.
Right.
They've also really tried to suppress academic research done by the federal government, you know, in terms of gathering facts and crime statistics and things like that, which is, you know, as the basis for policymaking, to have an informed discussion about what's the relationship between guns and violence.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, you can say, well, do we need to tighten mental health laws or programs, or do we need to focus on domestic violence? I mean, where is the real problem? And the federal government has been prevented from doing research on that very topic since late 1990s. But Obama, in his executive order, that was one thing. He said, okay, now the Centers for Disease Control, you can do research. In 2003, Congress said, you know, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms couldn't release any information tracing guns used in crimes. Well, now, you know, Obama said, forget it. You know, we're going to start, you know, making that information public. We're going to start using that, you know, to be smarter about what's the real problem. And he undid a bunch of things like that in these executive orders. Now, we'll see, you know, nothing happens overnight or at the snap of a finger. We'll see what really happens, and everything takes longer, especially in government. But when you say, you know, have the gun controls gotten looser in recent years? Absolutely. You know, before 1980, only 5 states allowed you to carry a concealed weapon. Now it's almost all the states. You know, another thing Obama signed was this notion that physicians can talk to patients about, you know, guns. Somebody comes into an emergency room, you know, under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, Harry Reid put in a clause saying a doctor is not allowed to ask somebody, do you have a gun at home? Is there a gun at home? And states like Florida actually proposed legislation, now stuck in federal courts, making it a imposing criminal penalties on doctors asking patients if there are guns. And other states, 6 other states, have similar laws. This is the kind of stuff that this is where it's gone.
Wow, so it's really
it's unbelievable.
It's just a radical change that's happened just recently. I got to end just with a quick question. Do we need, in your opinion, Steve Rosenfeld, from your extensive research into America's history of gun control and gun rights, do we need a new generation of gun laws, or just a return to tradition and the intent of the founders?
I think that we just need to return to a balance, some semblance of balance. Things are so out of whack. I mean, look, it is naive to think that we're going to become like England and get rid of 300 million guns.
Right.
It's not going away.
No.
So the question becomes, how do you better manage that? And that requires a balanced response. It's not like there's, you know, a complete, absolute, unfettered, unrestricted right to do whatever you want, you know, with guns.
It's not.
And on the other hand, you know, I lived in Vermont for many years. I respect the traditions of people who want to hunt and
sure,
and all that
absolutely.
Stuff. That's not what we're talking about here. You know, we're talking about, you know, just a balance. We're not talking about picking on the dealers. We're not talking about picking on, you know, the decent people. We're talking about, you know, just a balance.
Which has been.
And things have not been balanced.
That was the tradition until just recent times. Very, very illuminating. Steven Rosenfeld writes for Alternate and many other sources. Thank you so much for your research and for your illuminating real history. Facts are such inconvenient things, aren't they? Thanks so much for being with us.
Happiness is a warm gun. Is it one?